This week, the book review looks at the intersection of technology and life. First up, is the internet actually making us smarter? Smarter Than You Think is the title of Clive Thompson's new book.
In reality, when you talk to people and look at how they behave, they're actually really selective in an interesting way. They're constantly doing this form of metacognition where they're thinking, is this worth sharing?
There's nothing new about social media. Tom Standage, the author of Writing on the Wall, is here to talk about social media the first 2,000 years.
Does social media trivialize discourse? Is it a waste of time? Does it cause revolutions? It turns out that all of these questions and many more can be answered by looking at history.
Julie Bosman will have notes from the field, and Greg Coles joins us with bestseller news. This is Inside the New York Times Book Review. I'm Pamela Paul.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature, including fiction, nonfiction, and periodicals. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview.
Clive Thompson is here to talk about his new book, Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better. Hi, Clive.
Hi.
So tell me how my mind is changing for the better, because I feel sort of dumbed down a little bit every day by what I have to refer to online for lack of memory power.
The main thing that I think is really interesting, or a few of the things I think are really interesting, is that we have become much more social thinkers than we used to be. You know, this is kind of hard for journalists, I think, like ourselves, to understand. But before the internet came along, the vast majority of people never really did any writing or publishing or sharing or setting down in words of the things that they were passionate or interested about, or problems they were wrestling with, the things they were thinking about. And the last 15 years has been this just like unbelievable transformation. I would talk to these scholars of rhetoric, and they're like, yeah, even college students who were already writing a lot are writing like 40% more in their everyday lives, just talking about stuff they're interested in. So there's been this kind of big shift from being mostly private thinkers and wondering about stuff, having an argument in your head, to having that argument with other people, talking to them, hacking things out, discovering that there's someone in Australia who's obsessed with the same thing you're obsessed with.
So you are what now is known as a tech writer. You've been writing about technology for Wired, for Fast Company, for the New York Times Magazine for quite some time now. How did you come to this particular subject and to this argument?
I came to the subject of how technology affects the way we live and the way we think, partly because I grew up, I'm 45, I was one of those nerds that started programming computers when you had to plug them into your TV. You know, so I was aware that computers were interesting and they could do interesting, they could sort of think in interesting ways. But I knew I wanted to be a writer, so I studied poetry and political science at the University of Toronto.
So pragmatic.
Yeah, my mother was pretty horrified. You know, like, hi, Mom, I'm studying Canadian poetry. Not just poetry, Canadian poetry. But then I graduate in the early 90s, and the internet is just starting to poke into the mainstream. And so my nerdy passions unified with my desire to be a writer. And if you talked to me 20 years ago, I was completely pessimistic about this. I thought that, you know, the average person is sort of, you know, too stupid and too shallow, and we're going to have this world where only trivial stuff gets talked about online, and society is over. But because I'm a reporter, and I went out there, and every time a new technology would come along, you know, this hot new thing called Hotmail, or, you know, this radically crazy new thing called instant messaging or text messaging, I would go out and I would report. I would find out what people are doing with it. And I was consistently surprised at how interesting and playful and creative and innovative everyday people were being with this. And I was dragged by reality to being more optimistic. And essentially what happened is I decided after 20 years I wanted to put together all the main strands of what I'd seen happening.
So, you know, there was a book, I'm sure you're well aware of it, Stephen Johnson's book, which came out a few years ago, Everything Bad is Good for You, which sort of seems to make a similar argument. Did you read that book, and was that a jumping off point? Are there differences between you said and Johnson says?
Actually, in a strange way, more influential, I think, for me than that book was Johnson's book after that, which is his book about ideas and where good ideas come from. Because one of the things that he explores in that book, and it's really a summation of his books if you've read them before, is the fact that ideas are embedded in the world and in the people and in the connections around us, and that good ideas come from these sort of connections between things, between spaces. That is really close to the type of argument I'm making in this book, which is that because we're doing so much more living online and thinking online and perceiving online, it's like moving to a city where there's suddenly a ton more connections that happen.
Is this what you call the social sixth sense?
Exactly. Okay. Yeah. Ambient awareness.
Say like, that five times fast.
Social sixth sense. Yeah, this is what psychologists call ambient awareness, which is, you know, when you, you know, if you start using Twitter, there's this paradox where for the first week it just seems completely ridiculous. Like, why am I seeing these alerts on my friend's sandwich, you know, or some stray story they read on CNN? And then after like 2 months, you're like, oh, I see what's going on. I see their obsessions. Then after a year, you feel like you have this ESP-like connection to what's going on in their heads. You know, and that brokers really interesting intellectual connections. You notice more things. You learn more about other people's internal lives.
Well, it seems also that you sort of have an instinct to constantly express yourself. You know, when you have a thought or something happens, you think, well, now I've got to tweet this, or how shall I tweet this? Or
That's
if
right.
I were to tweet this, what would I,
right.
how would I phrase it?
The negative response to that tends to be, oh, this just is a flood of narcissism, right? People just sort of constantly, gormlessly talking, you know, about everything they do. In reality, when you talk to people and look at how they behave, and I've stood behind people and watched them tweet for hours to sort of figure this out. They're actually really selective in an interesting way. They're constantly doing this form of metacognition where they're thinking, is this worth sharing, right?
Tweet about candy.
Yeah, exactly. I will not tweet about candy. But, you know, if this is interesting, would other people find it interesting? And how should I express it? And I'll watch them try and write a tweet. And it's really funny. It's like I wrote headlines for the Globe and Mail for one summer back in 1994. And every headline writer knows this horror of like having to compress this idea into this short space. It forces you to be really creative. And I'd watch people rewrite a tweet like 10 times trying to figure out how to say it. And and by the time they're done with it, they were, you know, very happy with this concise, pithy way of putting it. So the urge to sort of to be in public produces a secondary response, which is I have to be more interesting, you know, which I think is a salutary force on our lives.
Let's talk about memory. There's this great Roz Chast cartoon that came out in the last year, which I'm going to now mangle. But it was something along the line of like, you know, dinner parties before the iPhone. And, you know, you just have people like, oh, what was the name of the janitor from that, you know, third rock from the sun or whatever? And just this total inability to communicate without it. How does technology affect our memories?
Well, you know, when I started the book, I was quite worried about this because I had the same thing. I thought, well, I don't remember phone numbers anymore. I find myself Googling for stray bits of trivia. Does this mean that the memory's leaking out of my head? What I discovered in researching it is that it's not as simple as that, because a huge amount of our memory is already outside of our heads. Like, and not just in the obvious places, and you know, in books and encyclopedias, but it's hidden in other people. Like, there's this thing called transactive memory where we understand the people around us are better at knowing certain things, they're kind of experts in one area, and so we rely on them for the details. And you see this a lot with your spouse.
Right.
If you're with them for a long time, you know, you get these hilarious fights, like, you know, how come you can't remember where the garbage ties are? How come I always have to remember, you know, where the IRS forms are? Well, that's because we've sort of subconsciously sussed out each other and realized, well, you're better at remembering that than I am, so you're nearby, I'm going to ask you. And so this is an old, venerable technique that we've used to become enormously smarter and more memorious by relying on the people around us because they're trustworthy, they're near us. And it took a long time for digital devices to be able to be fast enough that we could treat them the way we treat people. Now, the danger, of course, in a way, is that, you know, we have to remain attentive to the sort of corporate forces that are right. organizing how Google works, right? You know, like, you know, if you know, you have to be a little critical about how the way Google is doing what it's doing. You don't want it serving up always the top result that's some Google product, right?
Right.
But, you know, we've always had to disambiguate this stuff with other corporate forces, you know, trusting what newspapers tell us. The answer to not worrying about your memory vanishing is that your memory has sort of already largely vanished. Our brains are great at remembering the meaning of something, and they've always been dreadful at remembering the details, unless it's something we're right. super passionate about.
Well, I bring up another Roz Chast, great philosopher of cognitive science, cartoon where she said, you know, that a certain point during your life, you realize that your brain has a finite amount of space in it, and that for every new thing that comes in, something has to go out. And she then showed these, you know, captions where, you know, in Paris Hilton was, you know, seen last night in Los Angeles, and then out, you know, seventh grade algebra. But your point is that this frees up bandwidth in your brain for other things, too,
right? In a way. I mean, it's dangerous to analogize the brain to a computer or to a room. Actually, I think Ross Chass was probably pulling from the famous comment by Sherlock Holmes when Watson discovered that he did not know that the moon orbited the Earth. He was astonished, and Holmes said, no. The mind is like an attic filled with the choicest furniture, and so you don't want to clutter it with bad stuff. I didn't need to know that the moon orbited the Earth was not relevant to me. I'm going to try and forget it now. I think really the big challenge in a way for our thinking and for our memory is less to do with Google than it is to do with distraction. Mm-hmm. The one thing that is, I think, that is true and bad about our current state of affairs with technology is that a lot of these tools are trying to distract us all the time. And they're doing that because they're trying to sell us ads, right? Like Twitter wants you to spend all day there so that you can see ads. Same thing with Facebook. And so they're pecking at you like ducks, and that makes it hard to focus on something. And the one thing cognitive science shows is that unless you can sort of pay attention to something for a good amount of time, it's not going to sink in. It's not going to become knowledge, right? So the great struggle that I think is a struggle, although I don't think it's an impossible one, is how to sort of practice more mindfulness when you're using your phone to say that I want to read this book, I want to read this article, I want to focus on it, and I'm just not going to drift off into Pinterest or something, you know?
But related to that idea of, you know, that the brain learns best or retains best if it spends time focusing on something is the idea that process is so important to learning, and that the reason we don't use a calculator, for example, but force children to understand, you know, just a simple concept like addition from so many different angles is because that process, you know, that forces your brain to learn new ways of thinking. So, I mean, I wonder in terms of the developing brain, is it beneficial to sort of, you know, get from A to Q or Z in 2 seconds, or is it better for the child to learn how to page through old copies of the World Book encyclopedia? I mean, are we losing something in terms for children learning?
Yeah, I mean, children, you know, the old ways of teaching, the very physical ways, work really well and should be the primary ways of teaching them until you get to like later on in school. That said, I don't think there's any necessary benefit in leafing through an encyclopedia compared to looking something up on Wikipedia. The hard task is paying attention to it, reading it, rewriting it out yourself. In fact, writing is a fantastic generation effect that cements knowledge. One of the great upsides of the world we have today is that people do so much more writing and reflecting on the stuff that they're thinking about, right? You know, like every time you write a bunch of comments or have an argument online, you were about an article, about an issue, you were doing so much more to cement it in your memory than if you had sort of carefully scanned it underneath an oak tree in the sunshine, undistracted in
a park.
Although,
oddly, I think they've shown that handwriting something as opposed to keyboarding it has a stronger sort of effect on the retention.
I looked into that. Not as much as you might think. Where its effect is biggest is exactly where you suggested with children. Children learning the alphabet, you really want them to be handwriting it because the physical connections,
cursive
is beautiful, is very powerful. I think the thing about handwriting is that is not that it is superior from memory, but that it allows you to do types of thinking that are different from when you're thinking at a computer. Like when I write my stories, you know, I take all my notes on the computer because it's fast. I can get more stuff down when I'm talking to someone, and when I'm writing, I like to be able to edit and move around and have that sort of, you know, clay-like quality. But when I'm organizing my thoughts, when I need to figure out the structure of things, I always need paper because that's a situation where I want to slow myself down. And that, those nice swoopy arrows on you know, that are very connective and wonderful. So really, in a lot of ways, because we have this plurality of tools that help us think in different ways, we have this new task, a metacognitive task, which is thinking, all right, what am I trying to do and what tool will be best? Should I be banging this out in public with people, you know, on Twitter or Facebook or something? Should I be sitting quietly and reading a book? Should I be working really rapidly and iteratively on the computer, or should I be sitting with a pen and paper, you know? Because each of these modes has a certain cognitive style that we need to understand and appreciate.
All right. You, Clive Thompson, having worked in this area, written about it now for years and gathered all this research into your book, what personally makes you feel smartest about technology? psychology, where has it helped you?
I would say probably it is public thinking and being connected to other people when I'm thinking through a problem. Because it used to be that I would work on a story and I would be like, okay, I'm beavering away on this one and I'm not talking about it. It's going to be a big secret. And it comes out. And then someone would email me and say, oh, I wish you'd mentioned X, Y, or Z. And I'll be, oh, my God, that would have been a fantastic interview. So now what's happened is when I start working on a story, I'll start talking about it. I'll be right. tweeting about it.
Or, you used to keep it very secret.
Yeah, yeah. I'll be tweeting about it. I'll be mentioning it on Facebook. If I had more time free, I'd be blogging about it. And I will try and get that conversation happening earlier on because it so informs. There's so many smart people out there. If you're thinking in public, serendipity happens. They hook up with you. And I've learned so many things from people. And I've had that process of having to put down my half-formed ideas and utter them is really clarifying for the mind. And I like that clarifying process to happen before I write something. I think it makes my writing a lot smarter.
All right. Well, I feel smarter already having spoken to you. Thank you so much, Clive.
Glad to be here.
That was Clive Thompson, author of Smarter Than You Think, How Technology is Changing Our Minds for the Better.
This podcast is brought to you by Audible.com, the internet's leading provider of audiobooks with more than 150,000 downloadable titles across all types of literature and featuring audio versions of many New York Times bestsellers. Audible is offering listeners of this podcast a free audiobook when you try Audible free for 30 days. One audiobook to consider is One Summer, America, 1927, a narrative featuring Charles Lindbergh, Babe Ruth, Herbert Hoover, and Al Capone, by Bill Bryson. That's One Summer, America, 1927, written and read by Bill Bryson, and it's available on Audible. For a free audiobook of your choice, go to audible.com/bookreview. That's audible.com/bookreview.
This is John Williams, an editor at The Times, and I'm here with Julie Bosman, who has notes from the field. Hi, Julie.
Hi, John.
You have had a very busy couple of weeks with lots and lots of publishing news. Let's focus on a couple of those stories. First of all, a fairly big name in publishing has left a big job.
That's right. And this is a departure from Amazon Publishing. Just to bring everybody up to speed who may have forgotten about Amazon Publishing, this is the New York unit of Amazon's publishing group. And ever since 2011, it has been run by Larry Kirschbaum, who is a very well-known figure in the New York publishing world. He used to be the head of the Time Warner Book Group, which is now known as Grand Central Publishing, part of Hachette. Back in 2011, Amazon shocked the publishing world when it announced that it was beginning a New York unit of its publishing venture, which previously had been based in Seattle, and Larry was going to be its head. Now, this was seen as, kind of a shocking thing because he was such a well-known figure in the publishing world and because he was jumping over to what many publishers see as the dark side, Amazon.
And was this sort of Amazon's initial foray into publishing its own sort of material books rather than e-book?
It was. Until then, Amazon's publishing efforts had been pretty limited to genre fiction. And this was a sign that they were really going to try to compete with New York publishers on more commercial, more literary fiction, kind of a more general interest adult trade imprint. And Larry seemed to be pretty well positioned to be its head.
And is there any conventional wisdom about why he left? Who's replacing him?
Amazon announced that Larry was departing, and this wasn't a total surprise, but it did tell us a couple of things. One, that Amazon's New York publishing unit is really not doing very well, which is something that people in publishing have known for a while. They haven't really acquired a lot of big books recently. They've been very quiet. It seems like the major stumbling block for Amazon publishing in New York is that Barnes & Noble and independent bookstores have so far almost uniformly refused to stock their books. This was something that Amazon really came into their publishing efforts thinking that they would be able to convince Barnes & Noble to stock their books. Larry Kirschbaum met with Barnes & Noble executives repeatedly in the very beginning of when he started with Amazon. And those talks did not really get off the ground. Amazon, you know, despite their best efforts, they really tried, but Barnes & Noble just really dug their heels in and said, no, why would we stock your books when you are trying to put us out of business? We're not doing that. And that was actually a major problem in trying to recruit authors to this new imprint. And certainly literary agents said that they couldn't be in a position of recommending that their authors go to Amazon when their books were not going to be in bookstores. Now, let's keep in mind that the publishing world, despite all the buzz over ebooks, for overall, it's still 80% print. And for a lot of authors, it even goes beyond numbers. They want to see their books in bookstores. They don't want to be, you know, only in ebook. They need that. You know, maybe it's a little bit of vanity and maybe it's a little bit of visibility that they think is important for their image, but they want to be in bookstores.
And so who is replacing Kirschbaum? And also, you know, does this seem like potentially someone who is going to revivify the program, or is the program sort of, do you feel like it's fading away?
Amazon says that it is definitely not fading away. They say that Daphne Durham, who is the publisher for Amazon's adult trade and children's businesses, is going to take over Larry Kirschbaum's duties. She's already started, and Larry's going to stay working at Amazon until January. But I did get a sense that they are going to focus more on what they know they can do well, which is a lot of the genre stuff. But Amazon does say that, you know, they have no desire and no plans to cut back on anything that they're doing in their New York office.
Okay, still giving it a go. Well, another story that you worked on recently and published in the last week concerns the company that we just talked about as a sort of combatant with Amazon, which is Barnes & Noble. And this is kind of the reverse, where Barnes & Noble is trying to compete in the more electronic realm.
Absolutely. Barnes & Noble's had a really tough year, as people in publishing know. And this week, Barnes & Noble said that they are going to release a new black and white e-reader. This is an updated version of their Glow Light, which is an e-reader that they first released last year. And what makes this e-reader special is that it has kind of a softly glowing backlight. It's incredibly light and easy to travel. And it's, I believe, the lightest e-reader device on the market. Now, this was really an effort of Barnes & Noble to say, look, you know, we are still continuing with our digital efforts. We're still producing new e-readers. We are not going away anytime soon. I mean, there's a real sense of malaise with Barnes & Noble right now. And I think that they really wanted to get a positive headline out there before the holidays and hopefully capitalize on some sales. The problem here is that people don't necessarily buy e-readers because it's the lightest e-reader by 15%. They buy an e-reader because they think, this company is going to be around forever, and when I buy all of my ebooks on it, I want to make sure that the library is not going to, you know, disappear in a puff of digital smoke in a few years.
All the compatibility issues that come up with these technologies.
Yes, and I think a lot of people who are into ebooks aren't necessarily like the most tech savvy people. Let's remember who was really the initial audience and the initial buyers of ebooks. It was women in their 50s and 60s. Right. You know, they wanted e-readers because they read a ton of books and they wanted the text to be larger. And, you know, this is not like people who were buying the first iPods. So I think that, you know, analysts who know Barnes & Noble really well would say that Barnes & Noble has like a major problem right now, because anyone who's going to buy an e-reader, and there's a whole other issue of whether people are still buying a lot of black and white e-readers, which are,
rather than tablets that have a lot of color and multifunctionality.
Absolutely. Like, a lot of people think that black and white e-readers are a pretty transitional device. Mm-hmm. So if you happen to be in the market for an e-reader in November 2013, would you count on Barnes & Noble to be the company that's going to be there for you and keep your books forever? So that's a major problem for Barnes & Noble right now, but we'll see what happens this holiday season.
And it seems like fairly recently, I mean, the issue wasn't it that a lot of people felt like in order to really solidify itself in the face of a lot of uncertainty, that Barnes & Noble had to focus more on the sort of brick and mortar, like an almost retro strategy where you go back to the brick and mortar and you really say, this is what we do well. And the Nook was seen as potentially, you know, a dicier proposition. And now they're kind of reinvesting in it and trying to get people excited again.
Barnes & Noble's problems have not really been with the stores. The stores are still profitable. Granted, sales have been down year over year and quarter over quarter, but it's the digital division that's been very expensive. It's been a real money pit for Barnes & Noble, and they just don't know really what their digital strategy is going forward. Let's remember that their CEO, William Lynch, departed the company very suddenly this summer, and he was really the architect of their digital strategy. Hmm. People within Barnes & Noble would say that, you know, Len Riggio, of course, the chairman of the company who really created the modern Barnes & Noble, has been taking on a much more powerful role within the company. And Len has always been someone who's had a huge soft spot for the stores, who knows retail, brick and mortar retail, really well. So it'll be very interesting to see what happens in the next 6 months to a year with Barnes & Noble.
Well, and I guess we'll know a lot more about this particular product after the holiday shoppers make their decisions, which is probably starting to happen now.
Absolutely.
Thanks, Julie.
Thanks, John.
I'm Parul Segal, an editor at the New York Times Book Review, and we're talking today with Tom Standage, author of a provocative new book called Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years, which says that perhaps social media isn't anything new at all. It's been the mode of communication for most of human history. It's reviewed for us by Frank Rose. Welcome, Tom.
Hello, it's good to be here.
So this idea might seem very surprising to people, you know, that what we think of as new and shiny is actually something that's been part of how we've been communicating since the dawn of human history.
Absolutely. But my point is that you don't actually need a digital network,
right,
the internet, to do social media. You can have this person-to-person exchange of stuff where you have recommendation and copying and sharing and so on. With other technologies apart from the internet, you can do it, it turns out, with papyrus rolls, which is what the Romans did. You can do it with pamphlets. You can do it with poems written on slips of paper, which is what happened in the Tudor court and in pre-revolutionary Paris. So what I do is I go and look at all these examples of social media ecosystems that mm-hmm. existed before. And it turns out that they prompted many of the same questions, many of the same debates arose around these earlier systems, which means that we can answer many of the questions we have about social media today just by looking at history.
Well, what are some of these debates?
Well, for example, does social media trivialize discourse?
Yeah.
Is it a waste of time? Does it cause revolutions? It turns out that all of these questions and many more can be answered by looking at history.
Uh-huh. Could you give us a few examples?
Sure. So my favorite is probably the waste of time argument. So this is exactly the argument.
Too.
Yeah, right. So this is exactly the argument made about the social media platforms of the late 17th century, which were the coffee houses in England. And they were places where you went to share and discuss media with your friends. It was pamphlets, news books, broadsides, scientific papers, that sort of thing. And they were criticized by professors at both Oxford and Cambridge University for being a waste of time. And they were very worried that the future of Britain was in real danger because the next generation of students, the intellectuals on which the country would rely, were just spending all their time in the coffee houses, networking with their friends and reading what looked like trivial stuff. And this turned out to be exactly wrong because, in fact, the coffee houses turned out to be an amazingly fertile crucible of innovation. And
right.
all sorts of amazing things happened in the second half of the 17th century, the scientific revolution that comes out of the Royal Society, which comes out of coffee house discussions between mm-hmm. scientists. And they've all got into the habit of drinking coffee while at Oxford, where the first coffee house in England appeared in the 1650s. But then you get things like Lloyd's of London. Lloyd's is originally a coffee house where the marine insurers meet and then they start renting the same tables every day to do business. And it turns into the first insurance market. And then Jonathan's, another coffee house, which is where the stock traders go. And they eventually decide to turn it into a company. It becomes the London Stock Exchange. So you get commercial and financial and scientific innovation coming out of coffee houses. And I think there's a lesson for us today that going on Facebook looks like a waste of time to a lot of bosses, and they think it's social not working instead of social networking. But in fact, the future of enterprise software probably looks a lot like Facebook. If you think about it, it's a very good collaborative environment. So we see companies installing sort of business Facebooks internally to encourage collaboration and cooperation between their employees and to discover ideas and to encourage innovation. Mm-hmm. And some companies seem to be making a go of that. So I think it's that sort of thing that we can look at history and say, hang on a minute, what's really going on here?
Right,
and we sometimes get these surprising answers.
Then, as you note in your book, something changed for a period of time, like this idea of people becoming consumers of culture, passively taking it in. Can you tell us a little bit about when that happened?
So it happens with the rise of the penny press in the 19th century. And ironically, the New York Times itself starts off as a penny paper mm-hmm. in the 1850s. But the first paper that does this is the New York Sun, and it has a new business model. And the model is that instead of being a very small local paper, so newspapers had a circulation of maybe 500 or 1,000 people at the beginning of the 1800s. And they were extremely local and extremely open and social platforms. They didn't have professional journalists. Most of the stuff in those papers, if you go and look at them, is letters and speeches mm-hmm. and stuff taken from other newspapers. And it's all just circulating because Ben Franklin has made, when he set the postal service up, he made it free for newspapers to send copies of themselves to other newspapers.
Yeah.
So we have this amazing sort of swirling blogosphere of stuff where everyone's kind of reblogging everyone else's stuff. And it's great fun and it's very, very straightforward. But then what happens with the New York Sun is a new model emerges where the price of a newspaper is cut from 6 cents to 1 cent, mm-hmm. which means you'd lose money, except that if you ever then have more people able to afford it and you have a much bigger audience, you can sell advertising. And so you get this new advertiser-funded model. And by the end of the century, you have newspapers with a circulation of 1 million copies a day. And in order to print 1 million copies a day, you needed a steam press. In fact, you needed a lot of them. And in order to then set up a new newspaper, the barrier to entry was extremely high because you needed to be able to afford to buy lots of steam presses. And so we get essentially this sort of consolidation of media. And then we get even more of it with radio and TV in the 20th century. And media goes from being a two-way conversational, right, interpersonal thing to being a one-way, broadcast and very impersonal thing, and it's just the voice coming out of the radio. Mm-hmm. And probably the sort of, the nadir of this is the Nazis' use of radio and the Nazi Volksempfänger radio, which is the people's radio. It can only pick up domestic broadcasts, mm-hmm. so you have no choice but to listen to what the government wants you to hear. And this is as far away from social media as you can get.
Right.
It's essentially one person's vision being imposed on a whole mm-hmm. nation. And then what's happened since, of course, is that the internet has made it possible to reach a large audience for little or no cost. And so we can now recognize that the mass media era was a temporary phenomenon that arose because the cost of reaching lots of people was temporarily extremely high, mm-hmm. so only a few people could do it. Mm-hmm. And so we get these big corporations that own the equipment that can do this. But actually, the rise of the internet means we're returning to the social means of information transfer that happened before the age of mass media.
What does this mean now? I mean, are we going to continue? I mean, like the way I think most people access or consume media now is the second screen model. You know, we're still commenting and linking to newspapers and television shows. Is this going to change? Is this going to deepen? What do you think is coming?
I think we're in a period now where we are basically constructing a hybrid, and some hybrid is emerging. So the social way of doing things is in some senses turning more broadcast. If you look at the way Barack Obama or Lady Gaga use Twitter, it's basically
right.
broadcast. They are not chatting with their friends on Twitter like most people are. At the same time, established news organizations like the ones we both work for are trying to work out how to take advantage of social and make it, their friend, not their enemy.
Right.
And so that's really the experiment we're involved in. And what we're going to see going forward is that the mass media is not going to go away. Mm-hmm. There are going to be lots of things it can do much better than social. I mean, a really good example in TV is sport. You want to watch that live, or reality shows. You want to see that live. Breaking news. You want to probably see that live. And that's not the sort of thing that that social media can do. But social media is extremely good as a means of filtering the enormous amount of content that's out there, both from traditional organisations and media producers, and from non-traditional mm-hmm. new ones. And so we're using social media to filter what's out there. And that's exactly what the Romans were doing 2,000 years ago. Yeah. They were saying to their friends, I'm leaving town, could you keep me informed of the news? And they didn't want to hear absolutely everything. Cicero famously tells his friend he doesn't want to hear the gladiator results. but they are relying on their friends to distribute, filter, and comment on the news for them. And that's exactly where we've ended up again today.
And what does it say about us? Did you leave this with any sort of conclusions about you know, the human desire to communicate and what we're looking for and what is not working?
Firstly, the urge to position ourselves within social networks is, you know, built into
so
our brains.
Powerful, yeah.
It's what the neocortex of the brain, which is 80% of the human brain, seems to be for, mostly for social processing. And this is Robin Dunbar's argument, but I think it's very plausible. It certainly doesn't look as though the neocortex is there for using complex tools, because there are animals that have a complex tool use and don't have a large neocortex. It doesn't seem to be for mapping either, because there are animals that are good at mapping and don't have it. It seems to be for social processing. Yeah. So then you have the notion of grooming and grooming coalitions and gossip as a means of basically grooming via language. Mm-hmm. And essentially, social media is gossip that you can do anywhere and at any time.
Oh, nice.
So it's a way of grooming your friends and maintaining your position in a social hierarchy. So this is really just a way of scratching a prehistoric itch. Mm-hmm. But it's the easiest and most convenient way to do it that we've ever discovered. And it allows you to do it even when you're not with the other people. So I think there's something very fundamental about this, which is why it's so compelling and why I don't think it's going to go away. And more broadly, I think... the point I've made in many of my books, which look at aspects of the present in the past and the past in the present, is that technologies come and go, but they seem to push the same old buttons in our Stone Age brains. You know, so the idea that sort of technology can change human nature, I don't think is the case. I think that we can understand people in the past by looking at these parallels. Mm-hmm. And we can also use history to cast new light on the present by looking at these parallels, because actually the people underneath it all are just the same.
Okay, thank you so much, Tom. Again, that was Tom Standage, author of Writing on the Wall, Social Media, the First 2,000 Years.
Thank you.
Greg Coles is here with Bestseller News. Hey, Greg.
Hi, John.
What lists are we looking at this week?
Let's look at the hardcover lists, and I'll start over on the nonfiction side of things, where there are a few new titles. Starting at number 4, the conservative columnist Charles Krauthammer, and former liberal, actually, former Mondale speechwriter, has a collection of his essays going back over the last 30 years or so. It's called Things That Matter. That's new on the list at number 4. Then just below Krauthammer at number 5, there's a new book called 40 Chances. This is written by Warren Buffett's son and grandson, Howard G. Buffett and Howard W. Buffett. What I like about this story, the G in Howard G. Buffett stands for Graham, and Warren Buffett actually named him after his favorite investor and Columbia Business School professor, Benjamin Graham. Mm. Then Howard G. Buffett named his son Howard W. Buffett. The W stands for his favorite investor, Warren. 40 Chances is kind of looking at how we can improve people's quality of life around the world. It takes its title. Howard G. Buffett is a farmer, and he's really looked at kind of land use causes around the world, soil improvement, local farming, things like that. He thinks if we can have everybody growing their own food, it would reduce starvation and poverty. And so 40 Chances comes from looking at any farmer basically has 40 seasons in which to improve his crops. And he takes that as a metaphor then to say that all of us have about 40 useful years to contribute to society. I don't know where I am in that.
Yeah. Let's hope we have a few more left at least.
Yeah. Then the next book that's new on the hardcover nonfiction list is down at number 8. It's called Extortion, and it is by a Hoover Institution fellow named Peter Schweitzer, looking at politicians and how they use legislation as a way to leverage more money out of their donors, or extortion, as the title has it. Then at number 13, the thriller writer Brad Meltzer also has a TV show called Decoded. And this book at number 13 on the hardcover nonfiction list is called History Decoded. It's kind of an extension of what he does on TV. It's written with a guy named Keith Farrell. And it looks at 10 big mysteries throughout history, often thought to be conspiracies throughout history. It's got it looks at Area 51. It asks what the contents of Fort Knox are. It looks at the JFK assassination. Mm-hmm. And the fun thing about this book, it's a little bit like Griffin and Sabine for conspiracy buffs. It's got little envelopes with packets of evidence that you can pull out, you know, facsimile letters and journals and things like that to try to decode the mysteries for yourself.
Do you know if they happen to, do they normally fall on the side of the conspiracy theorist, or do they debunk as much as they?
You know, I think that you'll just have to read the book for yourself.
And open some of those envelopes. Okay.
Exactly. I won't give anything away. Then at number 14, the last new book on the nonfiction side of things is called Driven. It's by the former Green Bay Packers receiver Donald Driver, great receiver, written with ghostwriter Peter Golenbach. And it just looks back at Driver's career, at his early childhood. He grew up in really impoverished circumstances, and it kind of looks at how he was driven to succeed, how he overcame all that.
I forgot he had retired.
Just recently.
Yeah.
Then on the fiction side of things, there are also a few new titles, including both titles at the top of the list. They're new to the list this week. At number one, no real surprise here, John Grisham's Sycamore Row, which is a sequel to his very first novel, A Time to Kill. Hmm. He returns to the character Jake Brigance, the lawyer who was the star of that book, and looks at him about 5 years later at another case.
That's always been considered one of his best.
That's right. And it's actually just opened as a Broadway show.
I just saw an ad for that on TV. I didn't realize the timing. A lot of Grisham in the air.
Yeah. Then at number two, another book that's gotten just a tremendous amount of attention, Donna Tartt's new novel, The Goldfinch, makes its debut at number two. A little bit surprising there. She's always been considered sort of an underground, like a cult figure, mm-hmm. but, you know, like Thomas Pynchon, like some of these other cult literary novelists, they gradually build up a big following. It's like REM making the jump from college radio right. to mainstream radio.
To Madison Square Garden.
Exactly. So that's Donna funny, though, Tartt is now at Madison Square Garden.
It's just debuting. That's amazing. It just feels like people have been talking about it already for what feels like months, not that I'm tired of it, but it just seems like there's a lot
of that. The buzz around that book built before it was actually released.
Right.
And so there was a hunger for it once it was released. Our review in the book review actually appeared before the publication date. We don't do that a lot, but we do it every now and then mm-hmm. for reasons of, you know, scheduling, just when we're able to give something the attention. And we do it with permission from the publisher. Yeah. Is it okay if we run this before the book appears?
Well, she's obviously benefited from all of the advance buzz and all kinds of outlets.
That's right. Another person who has built his career, really he made it big with his very first book. 5 years after his first book was published, She's Come Undone, Oprah Winfrey chose Wally Lamb for the fourth person of her new book club back in 1997. And suddenly he went from an unknown author to like one of the biggest authors in America. And everything he's written since then has been a bestseller, including his new novel. It's his fifth. It's called We Are Water. And that is new on the list at number four. That one's about a dysfunctional family coming together for a same-sex wedding in Connecticut. He often writes about this kind of southeastern corner of Connecticut. This new book is no different. Mm-hmm. Then you have to jump all the way down to number 14 for the next new book on the list. It's called Silent Night. It's by Robert B. Parker and Helen Brann. The interesting thing here is Parker, who wrote these Spencer P.I. novels set in Boston, he died in 2010, and since then, the Parker series has continued with various authors. But this one, Silent Night, is actually a Robert B. Parker manuscript. He was working on this book when he died, and he left it unfinished. And Helen Brann is his longtime agent. She worked with him for decades, and so she had this manuscript. She knew his writing well. She knew him personally well and saw kind of where he was headed with this. So she finished the book herself, and now it's come out. It's a Christmas mystery. And then finally, down at number 15, and this just astonishes me. You'll remember a few weeks ago, we talked about Mary Oliver being on the list with her new book of poetry called Dog Songs.
Yeah, you did a lovely reading of one of the poems for us.
And I mentioned how rare it is to have a book of actual poetry on the list. At number 15 this week, the book Aimless Love by Billy Collins.
Wow.
Another legitimate poet, long time. He twice served as the U.S. Poet Laureate. Mm-hmm. He's been the New York State Poet Laureate. And his new collection, Aimless Love, it's new and selected poems. I will say it also has a dog on the cover. So I don't know if it's poetry that's selling now or dogs. Still, you know, you'd maybe expect to see poems by Billy Corgan on the list before poems by Billy Collins. He is very popular, though. He writes with a very accessible style, as does Mary Oliver. And since I recited a Mary Oliver poem, it's only fair that I recite a Billy Collins poem.
I love it. I see the open book. Today. Here we go.
You'll see this one is called A Dog on His Master, also told in the voice of a dog. As young as I look, I am growing older faster than he. 7 to 1 is the ratio, they tend to say. Whatever the number, I will pass him one day and take the lead, the way I do on our walks in the woods. And if this ever manages to cross his mind, it would be the sweetest shadow I have ever cast on snow or grass. That's Billy Collins, A Dog on His Master.
Very nice. I do not think it's a coincidence that your readings are coinciding with poetry books hitting the bestseller list. Maybe we're starting a trend here and you're inspiring people. Thanks, Greg.
Hey, thanks, John.
Remember, there's more at nytimes.com/books. Our producer is Jocelyn Gonzalez, and you can always write to us at books@nytimes.com. Thanks for listening. For the New York Times, I'm Pamela Paul.